Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for the Beyond the Mekong series as broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Dave Walsh. Dave is the country director for the Solidarity Centre in Thailand and Myanmar. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey Luke, thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
It's good to have you back.
Cheers.
Supply chains, migrant workers, and it's a difficult issue, but it's quite confronting. How important are migrant workers in Thailand to the Thai economy, which is wallowing, it's down?
Yeah, absolutely vital. And they come from throughout the region, but I think predominantly, and certainly over the recent years, from Burma, from Myanmar, given the political crisis there, and given the way the economy is stagnating in Burma and Myanmar, there's been an even greater influx of migrant workers into Thailand. And they are occupying jobs that are can be characterized as the most vulnerable, the most ripe for exploitation, where rights are abused without recourse, frankly, and where they're largely denied freedom of association and the ability to establish unions. And this is ironic, particularly given, frankly, that it's the mission of the Solidarity Center to promote freedom of association, trade union rights. We're involved in loads of supply chain cases that impact and involve migrant workers. Most of them, again, Burmese, although, of course, they're Cambodians in the construction sector, in seafaring. But if you focus on Burmese migrant workers, they occupy disproportionately, if not sort of entirely, the demographic within the special economic zones in Thailand, probably the most notorious of which is in Maesod, which is right on the Burma-Thai border. We do a lot of work there. There are egregious conditions, and I think it's a... if we can sort of pivot at some point during the podcast, the intersection is that A, they fuel the Thai economy in those industries, the special economic zones, especially the one in Maesod, is crucial. Loads of Western supply chain actors, who you know, operating there. Conditions are deplorable, but Thailand as well, frankly, has not only been the center, a lot of big supply chain victories in recent years. I'm proud to say the Solidarity Center was deeply engaged in a number of them. But given what they are doing in terms of developing their own legislation, and more importantly, in terms of leverage that they are negotiating, and we're moving asunder here a bit, but they're negotiating a very, very important, for the Thais at least, free trade agreement with the European Union. European Union law is pushing towards more and more accountability vis-a-vis supply chains. And what I mean by that is the missing element in all of these cases when we're talking about migrant workers being garment workers in Maesod, or name your major multinational in any industry, whether it's Apple in electronics, Nike in the garment sector. The one actor that is dominating the cycle in terms of essentially driving pressures down to reduce wages, to infringe on rights, to maximize profits at their end, but where there is almost no recourse for these workers, especially migrant workers, to seek some sort of justice and accountability from multinationals.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about in terms of supply chain reforms and what may be on the offer in Thailand.
How many people are we talking about? And when I asked that, there have been lots of wild numbers thrown about in regards to how many people from Myanmar are here in Maesod. I think it's put it between 250 and 300,000. Yep. I've heard millions in Thailand itself. Yep. What's your working number? Do you have an best estimate?
Yeah, well, both those numbers are accurate in different senses. In other words, even registered migrant workers, and by that I mean workers with legitimate, quasi-legitimate work permits, let's say special border passes, those are somehow registered under the MOU between the two countries, which again is ironic given the questionable legitimacy of the current Myanmar government, but leaving that aside for the time being, those would be in the several hundreds of thousands. But beyond that, just given the influx, and again, I'll try to pivot again to the garment sector, that given the influx of migrant workers into Thailand, the majority of them are undocumented at this point, and so the number of millions may be accurate. But let me just point out that, and let's take Maesod as an example of where the global garment industry sits and how it operates, that if the minimum daily wage for a garment worker is just over the equivalent of $10 a day, or between 300 and 400 baht, let's say. It's on average half of that in Maesod. And that's with the full knowledge of the Thai government. It's with the full knowledge of the special authorities running the special economic zones, certainly the Thai military, deeply engaged as well. And you would ask, is it solely because of the horrendous living conditions that was forcing those from Myanmar to flood the zone, as it were, in Mae Sot and elsewhere in Thailand. Actually, even half, to do the math quickly in your head, mm-hmm. both of us are at a certain age where we can still do that, I think.
Yep.
Half, if Thai factories operating in Thailand and Mae Sot are paying on average half to say two-thirds of what the legal minimum wage is and getting away with it, that is still almost double what the going wage is currently in Myanmar. Because there are still, and this is where the rubber hits the road, the Myanmar garment industry, which is, depending on how you look at it, 20 years old or 15 years old, but certainly in terms of, let's say, when Myanmar opened up, the years of Aung San Suu Kyi, Western brands were happy to flood into, and they should have been, and were encouraged to flood into to Burma, to Myanmar, to develop the garment sector there. Many have pulled out post-coup in 2021. Many are still there, especially right. Japanese brands. And given that they're operating in what I would essentially deem as the dream scenario for the global garment industry, namely a complete absence of the rule of law, and where workers are so desperately poor that they will essentially seek and tolerate employment under any conditions, that is the dream scenario. Now, despite the massive pressures that the Burmese trade union movement have faced, many of them are in exile. I won't say where, but certainly the Solidarity Center works closely with them and have been facilitating them during this. They remain active, even despite the conditions. Burmese unions, which are have largely been, in the absence of a rule of law, deemed illegal over the majority of the course of the post-coup period, they are still very active. They are still organizing. They are still confronting employers. They are still seeking to negotiate. They are still advocating for rights and have achieved measures of success. But I think it's also a reflection of the way the global garment industry operates, that they have applied no pressure whatsoever on, let's say, the military junta in Burma, but yet have enjoyed enormous profits by remaining in the Burmese garment sector. What I would say is it's very difficult to track numbers, but I believe Nikkei Asia, as recently as 18 months mm-hmm. ago, thought that, as far as they could tell, profit margins in the Burmese garment sector were almost back to pre-pandemic levels, which is quite an astonishing statement, right? So yeah. So that's a large pivot. What I'm saying is there's really nothing good to report in terms of the ethics and operations of the global garment sector. They seek out jurisdictions, again, characterized by an absence of the rule of law where they can seek it and where poverty reigns. And that's why supply chain activism, but when I say supply chain activism, I mean binding supply chain activism, is to my mind the key, and why Thailand, and by extension, given the amount of Burmese migrant workers who work here and essentially the proximity between where the Burmese garment industry is and Thailand, supply chain activism, introducing binding measures of multinationals, allowing recourse and a platform for workers, some of the most vulnerable and poor in the world, to seek justice and apply pressures directly to the multinationals who are benefiting most, is key. And there's a realistic opportunity that could take place in the coming months and years here in Thailand. So it's very exciting.
I was going to ask, how do you apply that pressure?
Yeah. Well, we do. I mean, you and I have known each other for
shame and blame.
Well, this is it. I mean, so you and I have known each other for a long time. I was the director in Indonesia, Malaysia, mm-hmm. Cambodia, Bangladesh. So certainly in Cambodia and Bangladesh, and I met you in Cambodia, the garment industry accounts for, you know, 70-80% of the export GDP. These are one industry countries in many respects. But people forget that the global garment industry itself deliberately invests, and it's the same 16 to 20 top names that you would recognize automatically that drive the conditions for the entire industry, and the sort of understanding among them after 20 years of doing this is sort of, as long as no one makes the dramatic but well-known step of how their supply chains could improve, no one else has to either. So when you're talking about how do you seek justice, I'm proud of the record of the Solidarity Center. Personally, I've achieved big victories in each of the countries I've been in, including in 2022, the Brilliant Alliance Thailand case, which at that point was the largest ever settlement in the history, not just of Thailand, but the global garment industry, almost $10 million paid out by Victoria's Secret. We're currently working on a number of cases, but one, if it's successful, will be the second largest settlement in the history of the global garment industry, which is quite a testament to Thailand being the home of the first and second weights that victory. I'm sort of saying that ironically, but what I would say is, while that's gratifying and certainly important for the thousands of workers that benefited from that, what always happens is that it's never a case of the brand saying, thank you for uncovering this for us. We had no idea.
Right, we'll correct our corporate policy and we'll address the issues.
We'll get back to you immediately. Sure. It's more like you've wasted, not wasted, that's exactly the wrong term because it's incredibly fulfilling work, but you've spent a year, in some cases 18 months, in some cases 2 years on one case, hoping that if it's big enough and you generate enough publicity, and that Brilliant Alliance Thailand case generated over 1,000 media hits alone, that it would have some impact on the industry writ large. It never does, and not even within the supply chain itself. And so if we're looking at what's absolutely necessary to have wide-scale systematic change, let's look at law, you know, a few cases of law and international law and globalization. It is possible to obtain justice in a globalized world. In international arbitration, company to company, government to government, there are means that if a government breaks a treaty, if a business breaks a commercial agreement with another company, there are means of international arbitration, there are means of bringing the other party to court.
And of course, there's the consumer.
Sure, sure. Well, consumer, in the normal approach to these cases in the garment sector, yeah. Again, is you know, the use of media, applying media pressure, stockholder pressure if necessary, consumer pressure, but it's incredibly unwieldy. And what's necessary is moving to the next step. Because if you look at all of the, just getting back to my point, it's only in the context of trade union workers to multinational corporations that there's literally no avenue, no recourse, no standing for a worker or a trade union to take a case directly that would have some potentially crippling impact on a multinational corporation. Why is that? The system is deliberately designed so that you have the UN guiding principles, the ILO Better Works program.
You've got a nice smile on your face
I mean, these things are better than their absence, let's say, but there's a reason why they're all voluntary. When I hear corporations taking on voluntary codes of conduct, that I have more of a smile on my face, I have a laugh, because it's utter nonsense. But there's a reason why these things are not binding, because the system knows that it couldn't tolerate an actual legal landscape where a corporation, name your multinational corporation, the garment sector, the electronic sector, would, because of supply chain non-compliance, whether it's wage theft, whether it's gender-based violence, whether it's forced overtime, whatever it is, all industries that operate in South and Southeast Asia are rife with these conditions. There isn't a single good actor that comes to mind, whether in terms of an industry or a multinational. And if you were to open the floodgates, it's the old floodgates argument in torts, the system wouldn't be able to absorb it. So as a result, you have voluntary agreements and you have guys like me and the Worker Rights Consortium and Clean Clothes Campaign and other international trade unions doing God's work, let's say, to seek a measure of justice with trade unions on the ground in Cambodia, Bangladesh, Thailand. And inevitably, I would say we have an 80 to 90% success rate, but the big cases require an enormous amount of investment and it never changes the system. So what's absolutely crucial is when you're negotiating free trade agreements, bilateral free trade agreements, for example, the European Union, I will give, which is now the hottest topic in Thailand. Thailand are negotiating a free trade agreement with the European Union. I don't want to get too much into politics, but what I would say is it was very, very important before the US presidential election. Now given tariffs and the uncertainty around that, it becomes issue number one in many ways because the EU is a crucial partner. The European Union, and I would credit European trade unions with this and progressive members of European Parliament who we're in contact with, their due diligence laws, due diligence meaning that multinational corporations have to assume some responsibility, a measure of responsibility, and expose themselves legally for misconduct throughout their supply chain. So they, the European Union writ large, are moving in the right direction. They have introduced guidelines, they are introducing regulations and laws for European Union companies. Individual members of the European Union, Germany and France come to mind, equally are doing that. So it's going in the right direction, but even with those good intentions, it is still being held back in terms of where it should be. But why I raise this, because A, the European Union is a crucial trading partner, it'll become a crucial trading partner for Burma and for Thailand. And in the free trade agreement context, which is currently being negotiated, and the Solidarity Center and other unions and progressive organizations, whether they're environmental organizations, intellectual property organizations, but intellectual property organizations from, let's say, a certain vantage point of consumer protection, are deeply engaged. And I have to credit the European Union, both the mission here, visiting members of the European Parliament trade committees, and frankly, even the negotiators of the free trade agreement have been very generous with their time, and we're consulting with them. It would be very ironic for the European Union, the member states, and the European Union in Brussels to be enforcing these or taking important steps to begin the process of having binding legal obligations on their multinationals, and yet have a free trade agreement with Thailand, one of, if not the regional supply chain hub, and not impose stringent conditions on European Union companies operating in Thailand, Thai companies producing goods, whether in the fisheries, garments, electronics, what have you, automotive sector, that are being shipped to the European Union, not to have some accountability mechanism within the free trade agreement and in the platform and an ability for unions and workers to seek justice for supply chain infringements. So that's what we're really looking for, and that's what I mean when I say Thailand has been A, ground zero of important supply chain victories in recent years, B, is the supply chain hub, C, has the crucial sort of, from a social justice point of view, the crucial value added of having a workforce where the conditions that most desperately need supply chain accountability, whether it's migrant workers or Thai unions operating under very, very, let's say, anti-labor, labor law legislation, et cetera, it's almost the perfect cauldron or to sort of say, here's where we need to go in terms of supply chain due diligence, and we're hoping the next few months and the next few years will produce that.
I think Maysot is a very interesting case. I've spent quite a bit of time up there because of the conflict over the last couple of years. The human trafficking and the scam compounds and the crackdown initiated by the Thais, the Chinese backing, where many have argued that they started it in the first place, particularly in Cambodia before it shifted to Myanmar. You've got the EAOs, the ethnic armed organizations who are fighting the military. You've still got a military presence in various parts, although they've lost control of Kayin State. And then you've got the Border Guard Force, the BGF, who kind of a military militia, but at the same time doing dodgy deals with the EAO. So how do you deal with that recipe of an alphabet soup of self-interest armed groups who people are fleeing from? And the way Thailand has cordoned off Maysot, for instance, you know, you can't get a, without luggage, you can't get a one-way ticket to Maysot for under 6,000 baht. It's ridiculously expensive, and the argument is that it's been kept that way to keep people in the Maysot area. It's, and then if you, for people who have been up there, they'd be aware that, you know, there's that three or four security checks you've got to go through. If you look like you or I, it's okay, we get a pass. Or a tie. It's getting harder. But the point is that the 300 odd thousand people who are up there, perhaps a lot more now, they can't get out of there anyway.
I go up there quite a bit, and as you say, it's an interesting combination of factors, and it's always like being in a John Le Carre novel when you're up there for a couple of days, because you bump into anyone from the senior producer for CBS to the UN Human Rights Ambassador, and you're wondering what the hell is going on, and there's a Chinese general at the next cafe. So
it reminds me of Cambodia
back in the day. Good times. I'll just give you an anecdote about how sensitive it is that there was, and this is all documented. That when was the last World Cup? So a couple of years ago, I guess December 2023. We were, and again, testing the system. There was a supply chain case where we were, A, testing the system, but also wanted to expose how difficult the need for the sort of binding nature of obligations that is crucial, because we had a case called VK Garment where the British brand Tesco were engaged in sourcing from the company, and the all manner of labor violations. And so we were attempting a case with the support of a law firm in the UK and a group of human rights groups and labor groups here in Thailand to do the equivalent of a case of basically forced labor in, among other violations, here in Thailand in Thai courts, while simultaneously taking legal action in Tesco, against Tesco. And just by way of anecdote, in terms of how sensitive this is, it hit the front page of The Guardian the same day as the World Cup final. So so there's quite a lot of publicity, and I was up there, and literally 70 major national police, including the Deputy Thai National Police Commissioner, descended in a helicopter, I assume to arrest me or us, but on the contrary, had no idea these violations were happening in Maysud. And how how could he help? And his people had no... But unfortunately, given you've spoken to the demographics in Maysud, it's almost more Burmese than Thai now, and probably is. We're unable to, unfortunately, we're unable to locate a Burmese interpreter and or anyone with knowledge of forced labor. So once we worked out those wrinkles, we worked quite collaboratively with the highest level of the Thai police force investigating this company. But that was one company. And that company, in a sense, I had a degree of sympathy for, because it's like shooting fish in a barrel. Every company by design, and that's the reason for being up there, almost every company, and I feel fairly safe to say every company, but every company that I've come across has, and we're building data in terms of gathering data on most of them, I'll say this, are in violation of some form, an egregious violation of some form of Thai labor laws, whether it's minimum wage payment, whether it's forced hours, whether it's forced overtime, I'm sorry, whether it's contracts not in the language of the employee, the inability of the entire zone to unionize, etc. And these are all Burmese unions, including the legal fiction that many of them are holders of day passes, special border passes. Yep. I believe they're called Section 64 visas.
I think it's a pink card, isn't it?
Well, that pink card's separate, but this was a visa designed for day laborers who, in theory, live in Burma, come across to work in Thailand, go back to Burma. Not the case at all. Most have been living in Burma for years and years and years. So it's incredibly sensitive, but you have major multinationals operating there. And I think The Guardian quoted me as saying that in a very noxious industry, the global garment industry, Maysud is very much the Wild West of that industry, because people only think of Cambodia, Bangladesh, maybe to an extent Vietnam, of course China, the maquiladoras of where the garment industry operates. It deliberately operates in a much wider sphere than that on purpose, because they anticipate, again, what attracts them, not the ability to enrich lives, to grow careers. What attracts them are, what I said earlier, the jurisdictions where the rule of law is incredibly weak and where poverty is usually overwhelming. But they diversify because of things like Rana Plaza, because of the heat that they will in Bangladesh in 2013, because of things like we experienced in Cambodia in 2014, where the entire garment industry shut down as a form of political protest for 5 days. They know the conditions are deplorable. And so as a result, they also know that there will be flare-ups and they need to switch production rather quickly. But the conditions themselves, writ large, are always the same, because it's the same 16 to 20 bad actors who dominate the market, who set the trends.
Right. Just curious, too, that we're focusing on the garment industry, but my guess is it would be other industries as well, but they're actually sitting back and targeting these areas.
Yep.
And the reason why I say that, I was up there about 2 years ago. I was interviewing a German PhD student.
Okay.
He was completing his doctorate on town planning.
And I'm
like, right, yeah. Right. And I'm like, why are you doing it here? He's like, oh, this is good. You know, I asked him to explain why, and he was saying that Maysud is a town built for 35 to 40,000 people. He studied the drainage, the water, the sewerage, the housing, commercial buildings, and this town is built for 35 to 40,000 people max. That's what it's designed for. But there's 250 to 300,000 people there.
And that's just the Burmese.
Right. And it's an extreme kind of overload on the entire system. And and as I was saying earlier, they're cornered up there by the cost of getting out, by the authorities, by the geography.
And visa restrictions as well. The visa system is, sorry to interrupt, it's deliberately set up to... deliberately set up to essentially pen them in many ways. But anyway,
exactly. And so these garment manufacturers and other industries, they're sitting back and they're going, well, that's interesting.
Yep.
Perhaps we should move our factories there. I mean, it's a hell of a call.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, though. I mean, it's perfectly in keeping with not just the garment industry, which we're picking on today, but name any other industry. There was, I mean, you know, we were, I'd love to do a podcast at some point just talking about the sort of, we've been doing media recently on the social auditing practices of, I mean, of industries, whether it's electronics or garments, whereby major garment industry, garment companies, name them, Nike, H&M, Uniqlo, whatever, create the legal fiction that they don't own the factory and they'd like to help but are in no position to do so.
Does this still work?
Increasingly, no, but I, but again, it gives them, what it gives them is a legal protection. So what they do from a public relations vantage point as well is have a whole industry, and this needs to be the next new focus of not just going after the brands, but going after these social auditing companies that are then tasked with investigating situations on behalf of the brand. Right. Invariably, they give a clean bill of health, you know, or very timid recommendations. But they're called in almost 100% of the time because of a known situation of illegality and oppression, are funded by the brands. It's a ludicrous setup, and no one involved in this sort of work gives them any credence. But again, it gives the plausibility to a consumer or to a journalist.
It's an interesting argument. I went back to Australia a few years back, and I don't want to sound like a fashion tragic, but I like my Levi's 501s.
Sure.
And I went to buy a pair. I couldn't find a Levi's shop.
Yeah.
And I started asking around, and the pardon the irony, or the pun, but the arse end had fallen out of Levi's in Australia because of what had happened in Bangladesh and other countries. Yep. And the consumers were furious, and they just blanked them all together. But in response, Levi's came out with an alternative brand that didn't say Levi's. I can't quite remember what it was. And it was being sold in department stores. Yeah. And the attitude from the sales girls was like, oh, you want Levi's 501s? We don't sell them anymore, but we do have this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was just thinking, you cheeky sods.
Yeah, it's shameless. I mean, ultimately, every brand knows what they need to do. It's only the top 15 to 20 in the garment sector, but we could speak of any sector that deliberately set the market trends, making no inclination or no real effort whatsoever to reform the supply chains. Will do so if caught, but only on an ad hoc basis. And so that speaks to why, you know, okay, workers have these social auditing companies, which they can't really approach. Multinationals approach them to interview workers, but again, what's absolutely necessary and what brands would fear the most, they have to invest somewhere. They're not investing, apologies to the new US president, they're not coming back to make garments in New York or Chicago. They're staying in Southeast Asia and South Asia and parts of Africa and the maquiladoras.
I noticed in Cambodia that the Prime Minister Hun Manet has all of a sudden, there's this Proud to Be Cambodian movement and Certificate of Authenticities. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I am wondering if that's to get around Chinese produced goods, which would be subject to tariffs.
Could be.
If they don't have
made in Cambodia.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. But what I guess my point was being, all of these mechanisms that brands have set up to insulate themselves, why is that? It's not to protect workers, it's to protect themselves. And the corporate social responsibility side is not tasked with actually reforming supply chains. They know full well what's wrong with their supply chains, and it's not rocket science. It's normally four or five obvious, egregious, but reformable problems in each factory from a worker rights vantage point. But why not give workers the platform that their suppliers have, which other corporations have, which is namely to be able to sue them internationally? So that's what we would be looking for in terms of free trade agreements. That's what we would be looking for. No more voluntary guidelines, no more buy-ins from UN programs, God love them, that you know, investigate and monitor factories, but where there's actually no serious consequence for legal violations, et cetera. We've been doing this for 20, 30 years. The time has come for, if you really have a system that's designed that won't break the floodgates, but which is doable, but start with binding, measurable measures that can punch back against the multinational, because A, they know what's wrong, B, they're capable of fixing the situation, but C, they don't want to, because it's incredible how greedy these companies are. If it's a markup of what we would consider negligible, it's fought. So it's all about the bottom line. Anything that will impact on that is resisted. But giving workers' unions a platform to sue multinationals, either through a trade agreement, an addendum to a trade agreement, standing in foreign courts, etc., that would be the most just, systematic, and the clearest and cleanest way for multinational brands, whether you're talking about the electronics, garments, or other industry, to clean up their act, because that's what they fear.
Well, as you were saying earlier, we've known each other a long time. I seem to remember the case of the Thai railway workers, I think we spoke about during our last podcast. But that aside, nothing much has changed. It's a constant battle.
Yeah, I mean, it's a constant battle, but it's very gratifying work. A constant battle marked by a lot of victories. But as I said earlier, the frustrating part of that is the victories are ad hoc and individual. That what we need is
the platform to sue.
The platform to sue and systematic reforms that would be industry-wide. Another option, this would be the topic I keep on selling myself to be on your podcast, but another topic would be, you know, what can producing companies do? Rather than in Southeast Asia, the ASEAN countries, what would be very effective is rather than playing each other off, saying we'll lower prices, we'll lower wages.
Does that happen anyway?
No, but
I thought there was some competition on wages.
What I'm saying is there's huge competition. So what would be interesting, what would be truly progressive, and I want to stay within the realms of reality, is rather than saying we'll crush unions more than you will, please H&M, Nike, Adidas, invest here. If they actually acted as a block and saying these are standards that to invest here, you cannot go below.
Right.
There's still loads of profits to be made. But that would be a measure as well, which would be heartening, which would be effective. But is it likely to happen? Probably not. But it's something, if you're talking about what measures ASEAN could take, acting as an economic bloc against multinationals from the West who desperately need
the AEC, ASEAN Economic Community, which is...
So that's another idea to float.
When industries come out and say we'll self-regulate, it's always been kind of laughable. Yeah. The people who end up with the raw end are going to be the workers and the consumers.
Yeah, and that's what's happening. I mean, the consumers less so, I remember my cousin in London sort of saying he supports the work, but he was for whatever reason not shopping. I won't shame him, but he was in a Primark store saying, "How the hell can this T-shirt made in Bangladesh only be $5?" And there's a reason for that. And it's worth Primark's time to sort of set the system up that the profit margins are sustainable, and not just sustainable, incredibly profitable, but you know, there are reasons for that. The most difficult question is when, whether it's consumer groups or whether PhD students, what have you, have said, you know, we're investigating this industry, what can we do? What would be the brand to target? And the reality is the system is geared as such that there really isn't a brand to target. It's all the brands are there's a degree of collusion in terms of how the system operates and is set up, that it's only going to be through these very doable, attainable, but systematic legal reforms, multilateral, global legal reforms that are necessary in trade agreements and elsewhere, that will give trade union groups, labor advocacy groups like the Solidarity Center, who can help them, a platform to say, you owe these workers, you name your Western brand, own these workers through your supply chains, $5-6 million, here's the lawsuit, with a quarter to pay up, seizure of assets, et cetera. That's not possible now. And the most exhausting part of this is that, I guess I'll close with this, you talked about
We are running out of time, but I do want to ask you, are we seeing the end of the end game and the start of a new push, which in terms of free trade agreements, giving workers a platform to sue over the next 6 months, 2 years, is that... It's where it's being pushed.
It's certainly a priority of mine. It's a priority of the people I work with on these issues. And it's something that is not pie in the sky. And especially being here in Thailand, as I said earlier, all the ingredients are here to make this very realistic prospect. And the more media we have on it, the better. So let's do another podcast.
Dave Welsh.
Yeah.
Always good to talk
to you.
It's been a while. And thank you very much.
Cheers.